This is the second part of a three-part interview. Starkraven Radio caught up with Eddie Huesca from Fuerza Fuerza, formerly Student Support for Migrant Workers, and Drew Garvey from Young Communist League Guelph, again in August 2009, and continued discussion regarding the recent reimposition of visa requirements on people of Mexican and Czech Roma descent. These requirements were implemented to specifically target individuals seeking refugee status in Canada and were intended to block the large flow of Mexicans and Czech Roma people into Canada. Discussion broadens into looking at the larger context of the Canadian immigration system and its recent trends, as well as some of the important issues being faced by marginalized migrating individuals.
So we talked a bit about why immigrants come here to Turtle Island, whose colonial name is Canada. Can you expand a bit more about the hardships of migration and touch upon what you consider as forced migration?
Sure. What has to be debunked is the idea that migration is an easy process, or that migrants come here on a whim or trying to abuse the system and things like that, because obviously migration is a very hard choice for migrants, and oftentimes not only puts them in great risk, but also they can leave their loved ones, and it's a huge life-changing decision that is far from easy. That's important to keep in mind when people are framing migration in a way that always depicts the migrants as these individuals that are coming here to take advantage of our resources or benefit from our system, and frame them negatively like that. These are people that need to move, and that should be recognized. I have a friend recently that I met. I don't want to exploit her story at all. I actually spoke to her about getting her story out, and she was really interested. She let me know that I could share her story. She came to a health clinic that I'm helping out with, a free health clinic for migrant workers participating in the SOP program. Basically, she came, and she was one of the last patients we saw on the day. Usually, we don't ask a lot of questions. The workers don't have to give us health cards or anything like that. We just see them. Little by little, we started talking to her and discovered that she was a non-status person. And what had happened was that she had recently fled to Canada. She actually had heard about the visa requirements earlier. I'm not sure how exactly she heard about it, but as soon as she heard that the visa requirements were coming into force, she quickly flew to Canada and fled, and now is here. Her two children are actually refugees, and they were granted refugee status. Before leaving, she was in the process of seeking treatment for a lump she found in her breast that she was really worried about, and that the physicians in Mexico had told her that was pretty important, something that she should really be concerned about and sort of seek medical services for. She actually had an appointment to go in and take a biopsy of the lump. It was this whole process already established in Mexico. But as soon as she heard about the visa requirements, she just jumped on a plane and booked it, knowing that as a non-status person, she cannot access healthcare because she risks deportation basically, and she doesn't have a health card. So a lot of people might frame this as like a really, you know, unrational decision. She's risking her health and all this, but understanding the importance of her fleeing Mexico and talking to her, she said that she couldn't stay there anymore, and she didn't get into the details just yet. We had just met, but she had said that, you know, her family couldn't be in Mexico anymore and they were in danger of their lives, and that's why her two children did get granted status, but as refugees. It just shows the bigger picture that these issues are so important that somebody might even risk their health in trying to move. It shows that these aren't easy decisions. It's frustrating when people depict all migrants as abusing the system when they're very much in need often. And what's interesting about her case too is that we're trying to inform her about what she can do now. What gets complicated is that if her two children are indeed, if they actually did receive refugee status, she could, like, the potential of her coming through family reunification is actually pretty good, because that's one of the routes that actually Canada is narrowing down the approvals for that as well, but it is still one of the easiest routes for migrants, is family reunification. So that would be an option for her, but she seemed not to be aware of it yet, and she didn't have all the information. Now that she's here, it would be difficult for her to go back there and reapply for it. That could definitely be an option, because we were definitely trying to figure out some resources for her to do now that she's here, and to try to seek some, as fast as she can, some treatment for her issues. Again, these cases are forced migration, and it's important to recognize that these are serious push factors that would make a person make these hard decisions.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying, and I agree that often the issue is framed, especially by our immigration minister, that these people are exploiting and taking advantage of our generosity. But the reality is that nobody's coming to Canada on vacation to take advantage of the Canadian immigration system. This is life and death scenarios for these people. We need to realize that nobody wants to leave their home. Nobody wants to come to Canada for no good reason. Also, we need to realize not only that we actually are the cause for a lot of this migration and what role Canada plays internationally in actually forcing migration and, yeah, causing people, the situations in people's countries to be so dire that they actually need to come to Canada. And that includes supporting free trade deals with Colombia, which tacitly supports their government, which is the number one killer of trade unionists in the world. That includes the war in Afghanistan, where we occupy and we've killed hundreds of thousands of Afghanis, Palestine, where we fully support Israel's government. Yeah, just all around the world. Haiti, where we support a military coup. Honduras, where we've supported, well, not really supported, but being the most vocal apologist for not allowing the democratically elected government back into Honduras, which is just recently. So, I mean, Canada has an atrocious human rights record around the world, and this really encourages migration all around the world for these people to come to Canada. So we need to take responsibility in our international relations and quit pretending that we're allowed to do these things, and then we don't expect people to have to leave their homes.
Can you just, for those who don't know, what SOP is an acronym for?
Sure. It stands for the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program, and it's a program that fills in Canada's labor shortages in its agricultural sector with temporary foreign workers. The program started in 1966 with Jamaica. Canada started bringing in Jamaican workers after Canadian farmers were pleading the government to allow them to do this, and they sort of based it on a program that was happening in the United States, which also brought in Jamaican workers and solved their labor shortages. So after a lot of attempts, and Canada refused for a long time actually, they actually tried tons of ways of using actually internal migration to solve these labor shortages. So they were bringing in, for example, individuals from Quebec, from the Maritimes, to work in Ontario and try to fill in these labor gaps. But they were not filled up, because what they found was that individuals would come, they would work for a little bit, notice how hard agricultural labor is, and they would just leave. They did not stay, and so again, the labor shortages kept going. After a lot of attempts, they were also, for example, bringing in, yeah, they tried a lot of things. So finally, they signed this program with Jamaica first, in, like I said, in 1966. And it worked, it started working very well. So then they expanded the program to include various countries in the Caribbean and as well as Mexico in 1974. So that's the program that is basically the SOP program.
Can you explain the significance of the visa requirements for Mexican and Roma refugees in the context of the broader Canadian immigration system and its recent trends?
Sure. To begin, it's important to, like we touched on, is to view forced migration and the idea of migration in a broader context than a lot of the times it is framed within refugee policy or law. If we look at refugees coming for a variety of reasons and understand that a lot of different factors can lead to somebody and should be considered as forced migration, even economic reasonings. If you can't provide a livelihood for yourself, for your family, that is a serious enough situation to merit or warrant your movement to a different country where you can get such an opportunity. So if we recognize this broader definition of migration, then in the context of the wider immigration system or the movement of peoples that Canada has been, the broader sort of context of Canada and migration to Canada, the placing of visa requirements on refugees from Mexico and Roma is a closing off of an important route that these individuals have to try to ensure themselves a better life. For example, as Canada has shifted to an immigration system that is very much similar to the United States and very fortified, which makes it a system which makes it almost impossible for immigrants to come in legally with full citizenship, having the point system and having increased the weight of the points based on education and qualification, whether you know you have a job offer, so making it very hard for low-skilled workers particularly to come in with full citizenship. That's a route that has been closed off, so now the visa requirements have closed off another route. Little by little, the options for migrants or for individuals seeking a better livelihood are disappearing, and the door for legal migration is being shut in their face. As an alternative, they're pretty much left with two options. One, obviously, is illegal migration, which puts them at intense risk, which they come to Canada and they pretty much have zero rights. They face the risk of deportation if caught. They can't access social resources when they're no status. They pretty much live, you know, in secret, scared, etc. Or they're obviously being pushed into the legal route of temporary worker programs, such as the SOP program or the temporary worker program, also the living caregiver program, which does offer them after, I'm sure that you, Mary, can speak more to this, but currently does offer citizenship after 2 years of working. Is it 2 years? Or?
Permanent residency.
Yeah.
It historically has been, but now, just with the Bill C-50, which I'll ask more about later on, it's not guaranteed so much.
Yeah. The idea is that they're being pushed into temporary worker programs, which allow them into Canada, but temporarily without full citizenship right, lacking a lot of rights, and basically sending them back after a certain amount of time, using their labor, using their contributions to our economy, but providing them zero. They're contributing just as citizens, but they're lacking the rights. So that is what I see, that these visa requirements are in the bigger picture, is basically pushing them into these routes. We can touch on a lot of the problems with temporary worker programs, but again, specifically on what the visa requirements mean in this context, is they are shutting a route that these individuals had been accessing as a way to come into Canada legally, not have to jump into exploitative temporary worker programs, but come in legally and be safeguarded against the oppressions that are caused in these temporary worker programs by becoming refugees and eventually getting full citizenship. That is a big thing to recognize. And that also touches upon when people say that migrants had been abusing the refugee system. And I mean, I don't see it as an abuse. If we're speaking realistically, yes, there are migrants who jumped into the refugee route who don't qualify as refugees in the definition that Canada has and internationally, the international community has defined of a refugee. Again, you know, my stance is that the definition is far too narrow. Understanding this, you do see that this is a route that's open for these individuals who have really, you know, I don't want to go over everything we just said, who have a real need to move and to migrate. If this route is open, then individuals are going to use it. You have to be resourceful when your life is in trouble or when your livelihood is at risk or etc. You are going to use your resources, and if this route was open, well, you're going to use that route and you're going to use it as much as you can. But this should not be seen as an abuse. It should be seen as a use of a route in the context of other routes being closed and in the context of a country that has failed the obligations to understand the bigger picture.
I totally agree with Eddie, and I think in general is if you come as a refugee and you're lucky enough to be admitted, then you do have significantly more rights than somebody on a temporary worker permit would have. Obviously, you're here more permanently. So temporary worker permits are just like a way of drastically reducing rights. And if you have people working in a country, a population in a country, which if these people are contributing to the economy, they are a population in Canada, they're not citizens, but you know, you have one group of people in the country with rights and one group of people in the country without rights or with reduced rights, that is at least analogous to an apartheid system. So I think it's fair to say it's an analogy of apartheid.
So labor segmentation, you have created two, like Drew's saying, you have created two labor markets that are different, and in one labor market don't have full rights, and the other you do. And we have to recognize if this is a society that we're going to be wanting to live in, where, for example, the temporary worker program has been expanding a heck of a lot. For example, I just read a little while ago that Tim Hortons is starting to hire temporary worker programs. It's expanding to service-related fields, including restaurants and things like that. So you can possibly walk into a Tim Hortons and all the staff working is going to be from a developing country or et cetera, they're not going to have full rights. You're creating a society where all these jobs that Canadians don't want to do are filled up with people who they're not giving, you know, adequate rights to. Really, that's a messed up society.
What do you think right now are amongst the most important issues being faced by migrant workers and non-status people?
There's a lot of issues, for sure. If you do a search on what people are researching to do with migrant workers and et cetera, or a Google search and stuff, you'll get a whole bunch of different issues. Recently, a lot of focus has been put on access to healthcare and the health status of migrants and immigrant and migrant workers and non-status peoples. Not so much on non-status peoples in Canada, but more on migrant workers in Canada. There's actually a few papers that are about to come up on this on this topic. There's been extensive research that has been done. And the reasoning is that they're finding that a lot of migrant workers, this is first about migrant workers, are not accessing mainstream healthcare. And they do have the right to access this healthcare. They're provided with health cards and coverage. They have insurance through the Royal Bank of Canada, or RBC insurance. So they do have insurance. They should be accessing it and everything. But there's a lot of barriers that are being found for them not to access it, right? For example, in the summer, I'm working for a migrant worker clinic, and we're holding free open clinics in different regions where migrant worker populations are more concentrated. And we're trying to identify what these barriers are and trying to alleviate some of these barriers that's in the long term, but also immediately see workers and address their concerns. We're finding quite a bit. We're finding issues to do with, for example, with pesticide exposures and pretty intense burns from pesticide, and situations where workers who are both spraying pesticides and working in crop fields that have been sprayed are not receiving proper pesticide training, do not have adequate PPE or personal protective equipment, which is supposed to be provided to them from their employer, because in Ontario, they are covered by the Health and Safety Act. They're not receiving this. There's other issues where there are a lot of eye health issues. They're not using protective safety glasses that obviously are not being provided by their employer. Just a lot of health issues. And we're trying to figure out why they're not accessing healthcare. They're not using preventative measures, etc. What has been finding, like, at the root cause of this problem is the relationship with their bosses, which is the definition of the whole SOP program, pretty much. It's the fact that these workers are, like we have been talking about, do not have full rights and are very marginalized within this program, particularly in their power relations vis-a-vis their employers. Their employer pretty much has an unprecedented level of control over them. These workers are living on the property the majority of time. Sometimes their employer rents a bunkhouse outside, but owns the property that they're living in. A lot of them, what we're finding is that they don't report their health concerns because they have fear that if their employer finds out, that they're going to be repatriated and sent home and replaced by a healthy worker. There's tons of documented cases when this happens, right? In our clinic last year, we had a worker who strained his back lifting a heavy load of vegetables, and he came to the clinic and he barely could walk. One of our doctors, the doctor on call at our clinic, basically said, I need to see him in 2 weeks, prescribed him some painkillers, but he wanted to see him in 2 weeks and this and that. And the worker was very nervous because he said that his employer had been telling him that he's going to send him home because obviously he can't work, so what good is he to him, kind of thing, right? We were really worried because we had heard that, you know, these cases do happen. So basically the doctor called consulate. This was the Mexican consulate, pretty much. The doctor called the consulate, which is a phone number that every worker is given. Obviously, this is in the case of Mexican workers in emergency. So the doctor called the consulate and said, this worker is scared because he has heard his employer threatening to repatriate him. I am telling you as a physician, he's not in a position to fly. It is detrimental to his health. He should not fly. I want to see him in 2 weeks, so I need to ensure that he doesn't leave the country and that he stays here. The consulate on the phone, there was a lot of witnesses because we all had him on speakerphone because we were all really nervous about this case. He said, don't worry, we're going to keep him. That sounds good. You have my word. No jokes. The next day at 5 a.m., they had him on a plane back to Mexico. The consulate came in. The employer came in to catch everybody off guard because we still didn't believe, because we've heard cases like this before. And we provided him with emergency phone numbers of different outreach groups, community groups, to say, at the moment you feel like this is going to happen, your employer is going to send you back, call this number and we'll try to do an intervention, right? Because, I mean, even for these cases, these workers have the right to compensation. But as soon as they go back to their home country, that connection is lost, right? It's very hard to reconnect with workers who have been repatriated and try to seek the root of compensation. Basically, we gave him all these numbers. They came in at 5 o'clock in the morning when he definitely wasn't ready. They just had him pack up his stuff and he was on the plane. This is the relationship that these workers have and the disposability that these workers have. That really speaks to their ability to really prioritize their health. What this program has created is a situation where they're having to choose between their job and their health, which no worker should have to do. Canada has worked long and hard. It's not perfect yet, but we've gone to a situation where workers have a right to health things and compensation and stuff like that. This new wave of temporary workers, they have the rights on paper, but the way the dynamics are set in the program, they definitely cannot access them without fear that they're going to be repatriated. When you come, again, touching on migration, when this opportunity is huge to you, when you're making an income that is a lot more than you can make in your home country, you really fear losing your job, and you really would not speak out if you feared that you were going to lose this livelihood, right? I would say that that's a big problem.
Anything to add, Drew?
Yeah, I definitely don't know as much as Eddie about, like, the health issues. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's really important. In terms of deportation, especially, like, I mean, temporary workers can still be deported when they're, you know, either they try and organize for labor rights, or they hurt themselves at work, or their employer hurts them at work. But non-status people are always under the threat of deportation, especially recently with the raids this spring and an increasing U.S.-style so-called war on illegals, where they...
Talk a bit more about that.
Yeah, this is the first time that we've seen aggressive enforcement tactics used by immigration officials, where they actually raid workplaces. They'll be at the mall actually asking people that might be illegal for credentials or for status, which is racial profiling. Also posing as lawyers, waiting outside of women's shelters. This is really nasty stuff. There was a case in Toronto of immigration officials came into the school where these two kids were going to school and basically held them hostage and called their parents, who were non-status people, and said, "We've got your kids, turn yourself in," basically. Crazy, crazy stuff. I'll leave it at that.